barreling across your computer, barreling across your MP3 player. It's Liberty Conspiracy Audios, brought to you by none other than the Conspiracy for Freedom, LibertyConspiracy.com, and all of the conspirators out there. I'm Gardner Goldsmith. Thanks very much for joining us. This guerrilla podcast brought to you by a number of great people, the fine, fine folks at FreeKeen.com. FreeKeen.com is a website where you can get audio, video, and blogs that chronicle the transition to a freer society in Keene, New Hampshire. Check them out. Also, our friends at the Freedom Book Club, freedombookclub.com, where freedom lovers can go congregate and vote for the book of the month that they would like to see promoted. And by voting, they give their tacit agreement to purchase the book each month. Some interesting stuff over there, new discoveries, and it helps concentrate the purchasing power of freedom lovers on one book a month to help get more attention and more sales for that book and the author. And also our friends at SACL CAI, Jason Osborne and the gang in Defiance, Ohio. SACL is a great company that helps large businesses get what is owed them without losing their customers. They'll even purchase charged-off receivables for you. So if you're involved in education, medical industry, you're involved with banking, law, anything like that, large businesses, contact SACL. They'll do it right for you. And they'll even purchase what's owed you, give you the money for it, and then they'll try to recover what is owed you. SACL, C-A-I, S-A-K-A-L-C-A-I.com. Okay, as the music winds down, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for becoming members of the conspiracy. Whether you listen to us at iTunes or anywhere else, you can listen to us on your computer. But in addition to that, you can also get over to our forum. It is open, and I'm really pleased that everybody's stopping by to check things out. You can comment on items that are listed at the website, written articles or links. You can comment on links that are provided on the right side of the page to many of our pro-liberty supporters, our friends in the conspiracy, people like the Blog of Bile, Free Keen, all sorts of folks that are listed over there, or some of the articles that are listed and we talk about here at the podcasts. If you want to discuss the podcast, just get on into the forum and you can bring up one of the subjects. It's really easy, and we really appreciate your comments about all sorts of things, whether it's freedom-oriented or it's just cultural. We have a lot of forum posts about books, movies, music, DVDs, television, all sorts of things that people find interesting in addition to freedom. We have a really sharp audience, both for the Liberty Conspiracy website and our Liberty Conspiracy audios. All right, I'm Gardner Goldsmith. Email me at libertyconspiracy@yahoo.com. I like to make sure that when we're doing the casts, we give you something that you can take with you, whether it's to work out, whether you're driving in your car. It's a really great way to turn written articles or items of interest in the news into audio format that is much more portable than having to take your computer with you and having to read while you're driving in your car. It doesn't work. So doing verbal podcasts is a really good way, I think, to disseminate the ideas of freedom, free markets, individual liberty. And in our last cast, we were touching on a subject that has made many people really frustrated, gotten them very, very angry. It's this mandate by the federal government that all televisions, in order to receive a television signal, must be fitted with a new digital converter box because analog broadcasting will be verboten starting February 17th, according to federal law. The law was written in 1996 as part of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Originally, this was supposed to happen in 2006, but it was pushed off. But the date now approaches. It's only a few weeks away, February 17th, 2009, when everybody's going to have one of these dumb converter boxes and shell out the money to be able to watch a television that they already purchased and thought they'd be able to watch when they purchased it. Well, the government is changing things for everyone, and they're changing things for the broadcasters. They're forcing broadcasters to have to broadcast in digital only. Now, in order to really get a handle of this issue, beyond just the visceral frustration and anger that people are feeling, which I think is really great. It's healthy. It's a healthy thing to feel angry. Sure it is. Well, it is good to feel angry about government because you're getting screwed. Government is illegitimate, immoral, and unethical, and economically backwards. Always. Always. There is no way that anybody can make an argument that government is helpful to anyone. It's impossible. We'll get into that a little bit later as I do an analysis of public choice theory, maybe next week. I'm going to have a multi-podcast, probably a multi-podcast about that one, to start to unravel some of the assumptions that people think that government can actually bring utility maximization in any way whatsoever. But that's a little something for our economic discussion in just a minute. Right now, we're going to go historical. How did we get to this point where the federal government can tell people that in order to be able to watch television, they have to go buy something and fix it to their TV sets? Well, how did we get to this point? And how can we get more people angry and frustrated at the same time they're learning something about the illegitimacy of these types of rules? Well, what we need to do is not just go back to 1996 and the Telecommunications Act of 1996, but to go back to the early 1900s, 1911 and 1912 to be precise. And in part one of this multi-part cast, you heard some information about the history of the government getting involved in what? Yes, that's right, regulating the radio spectrum. That's where it all comes from. It's not just a matter of people saying, I don't like the fact that they came up with this rule in 1996. What you need to do is get to the root of it. Where does it all come from? It comes from an illegitimate move by the federal government in 1911, 1912 to begin regulating the radio spectrum. We talked about it in the last cast, and we're going to continue right where we left off at the end of that cast with the passage of the Federal Radio Act of 1927. Here's the rest of the story. The rest of the story. Under the Federal Radio Act of 1927, no one could start a radio station without permission from the Federal Radio Commission. Since it had already established in the Radio Act of 1912 that the government owned the airwaves, the Federal Radio Commission was once again given the power to grant licenses, and this time they would do so only to those who were going to serve the public interest, the very language Herbert Hoover had been spouting for years. And as an aside, I just wanted to bring this up, Hoover himself had proposed a 2% radio sales tax, which would be used by the federal government to hire talent and bring refinement to the airwaves. Meanwhile, the Federal Radio Commission began issuing orders to make radio, quote, better. In quaint fascistic fashion, the Federal Radio Commission General Order No. 4, issued on April 5, 1927, allowed radio licenses to be issued only for stations prepared to operate between 550 and 1,500 kilocycles. The band between 1,500 and 2,000 kilocycles was off limits. Federal Radio Commission General Order No. 5, issued the next day, stated that any station operating without a license or a temporary permit after April 24, 1927, would be shut down. And on April 26, 1927, the Federal Radio Commission General Order No. 6, I'm not a number, I'm a free man, stated that no new applications for portable licenses would be issued. It also stipulated that any licenses for portable stations that had been given at the outset of the Radio Act of 1912 would be attenuated, allowing them to operate at only 100 watts maximum output for no more than 120 days maximum in one stretch and between 1470 and 1490 kilocycles. Isn't freedom wonderful? How funny it is that we're starting to see the same sort of mandates regarding analog broadcasting as they had all the way back in 1927. This is why we're running into problems today, because government doesn't change. It takes over the private sphere and it uses it to gain money and power for those people who are in office or for the people that they appoint. It is an absolute travesty that government is in any way running the radio spectrum. And you know, they claim that they're doing it for the public. Let's talk a little bit about this public interest thing that Herbert Hoover first started bringing up, as we mentioned in our last cast, and we'll continue talking about it. There's a funny thing about the term public interest. Those who toss it about like throw pillows seem incapable of understanding that the faceless public, as they call it, is made up of individuals, each with his own perspective and his own interests. To decide for someone else what is in his interest is the height of arrogance and should not be left to anyone, least of all self-important politicians. But the men who rose to the top of the political swamp in the 1920s and 1930s disagreed. For them, and the corporations they seduced with their power grab on the federal level, the public interest could in no way be defined by the individuals who actually comprised the public. It had to be decided by, quote, leaders, end quote, regardless of the interests people might reflect with their own pocketbooks, and regardless of the U.S. Constitution. By the late 1920s, politicians had begun to realize the usefulness and importance of radio. In 1924, Huey Long spread his messages across Louisiana in his race for governor of the state, offering one of the earliest examples of a radio campaign. 4 years later, New York Governor Al Smith used radio to reach millions of Americans in his quest to be elected president. It was a time of excitement for big broadcasters and politicians alike. The big broadcasters had fresh business opportunities nationwide, and the politicians realized that a new medium with which to barnstorm or add virtual whistle stops in living rooms from coast to coast now existed. Both groups understood that it was important to retain government control of the medium. With that control, government-connected businessmen could exclude competition, and politicians could spread their messages and gain political friends in the form of big radio corporations. All the two groups needed was the legal apparatus to give them that power, and Hoover helped them get it. By continuing to federalize the radio airwaves, he created one of the most efficient examples of mercantilism in history, something Adam Smith would have found astounding. But the shrewd Hoover was soon to be outdone by the very man who had been one of his big boosters. By the early 1930s, it was time for Hoover to step aside and for an even more devious politician to step to the fore. It was time to actually use the federal government to stifle political dissent. In other words, it was time for Franklin Roosevelt. Early in his first bid for the presidency, Roosevelt learned a valuable lesson about the new power of radio. By 1932, he had encountered strong opposition from many major newspapers, and he and his campaign advisors had to find an alternative method of getting their message to the people. They opted to circumvent the written word by using the spoken one, undertaking a massive and hugely successful radio campaign that would not end with the election and would establish Roosevelt as the first masterful radio propagandist in U.S. history. His spin machine was the first of its kind, and it went into overdrive at the outset of the federally inspired banking crisis of 1933. As people lost their shirts due to federal monetary policy and unconstitutional restrictions on diversification, FDR stepped forward to target the scapegoats. No longer fettered by the need to pay for radio time, as he had been forced to do during the presidential run, he took advantage of his position as president to get free airtime and, basically, blame the crash on private business. What a guy. Using biblical language, he railed against the greed of bankers and stock traders, calling them the money changers in a series of on-air speeches or, quote, fireside chats, end quote, broadcast all across the U.S. For many Americans, those chats were reassuring. Even today, historians sing their praises like drunken bards and seem to pine for those simpler days when one calm authority spoke to all the feckless underlings searching for hope, when radio was not a realm of contentious debate, but a conduit for the one true America to listen to its great leader. This simplistic historical view misses two important points. First, Roosevelt was acting in a fashion that was far from American. In fact, Roosevelt's approach to the radio market had less in common with American leaders than it did with his counterparts in charge of Germany, Italy, and the USSR. He was clearly exploiting his position to berate and belittle his political opponents while accreting power and authority to himself. He was using government in fascistic and communistic means to spread his political message, justify his policies, and stifle dissent. Second, contrary to the sanitized version of FDR history spoon-fed to all of us, there was political dissent, and those engaged in it had listeners, fans, and influence. The more influence they had, the more Roosevelt disliked them, and the more he worked to bring about their removal from the air. The most prominent figure among them was Father Charles E. Coughlin, a, quote, anti-capitalist, anti-communist, end quote. Interesting combination. if you can combine them, who initially supported Roosevelt's New Deal and later depicted it as the product of an international banking conspiracy. Coughlin was a controversial and evidently confused commentator whose radio monologues were heard by millions across the nation, including those listening to the conservative Yankee Network, which owned numerous stations throughout New England. As Congress and Roosevelt retooled the Federal Radio Commission, which had to be reauthorized each year, into the Federal Communications Commission, which could regulate the upstart television industry and operate in perpetuity unless stopped by Congress in their own action, as the executive and legislative branches increased the size and scope of federal programs and poisoned the atmosphere against private industry and private property in general, Coughlin lashed out, calling FDR Franklin double-crossing Roosevelt and inspiring Democratic ire. His rant soon prompted Roosevelt to recruit the very upstanding and supposedly Catholic Joseph Kennedy to talk him down from his perch, but Coughlin would have nothing to do with him, and Kennedy eventually warned Roosevelt that Coughlin was becoming, quote, dangerous and a, quote, demagogue who had to be stopped. In 1939, Roosevelt attempted to do just that, exploiting a business rivalry between the Yankee Network and the Mayflower Broadcasting Company as a pretext for FCC intervention in favor of his political friends. According to Thomas W. Hazlitt and David W. Sosa of the Cato Institute, Mayflower had, quote, submitted a competing application to be granted a license to operate WAAB, one of the Yankee Network's Boston stations, end quote. And Mayflower's attorneys claimed that Yankee repeatedly broadcast, quote, political endorsements and partisan coverage of controversial issues with no concern for fairness and balance, end quote. According to Hazlitt and Sosa, the challenge was eventually dismissed, but the FCC took the opportunity to review Yankee's license and demand certain concessions in return for continued permission to stay in business, stating, "Radio can serve as an instrument of democracy only when devoted to the communication of information and the exchange of ideas fairly and objectively presented. Indeed, as one licensed to operate in the public domain, the licensee has assumed the obligation of presenting all sides of important public questions fairly, objectively, and without bias. The public interest, not the private, is paramount." As well-tailored as the previous statement appears, it is also very revealing as an example of the egalitarian, elitist, and anti-constitutional mindset that had begun to infest the federal government at all levels and in all branches. The founders stood for something completely different, and they might have had a few questions for those 20th century bureaucrats had they been alive at the time. For example, since when was radio supposed to be a, quote, instrument of democracy, end quote? If there was one thing the founders distrusted and fought against, it was pure democracy. Unrestricted majority rule left private property in danger of seizure and attenuation, which worked in complete opposition to individual liberty, prosperity, and even one's own survival. According to the founders, and the Lockean philosophy upon which they based the U.S. Constitution, protection of one's life and his private property was the only justified rationale for the creation of government. Once government, particularly through democracy, began to do that which we could do to one another, namely take each other's property and threaten each other's lives, it became illegitimate and deserving of rejection. In order to check the potential that the federal government could be used in this perverse manner, the Founding Fathers wrote a very strict rule book in the form of the U.S. Constitution and gave very limited powers to the central authorities in Congress, the executive, and the Supreme Court. The federal system is not based on democracy, but on representative federalism. To think that the bureaucrats in the FCC could attempt to decorously justify such an ahistorical, unsupportable doctrine of pure democracy is pretty terrifying. We ought to be happy that the members of the FCC weren't aboard the original Mayflower, or every inhabitant of Plymouth Plantation might have starved to death trying to promote the public interest rather than the private. We ought to feel lucky that the FCC board members weren't present at the Constitutional Convention. If they had been, perhaps they would have lobbied for federal control of newspapers, justifying their position with such lyrical drivel as, "Newspapers are instruments of democracy," or, "When considering newspapers, the public interest, not the private, is paramount." Even if one were to overlook the obvious constitutional, philosophical, and ethical problems posed by such decorous language, how does one surpass the logical hurdles set along this path to democratic nirvana? How does one create a group
the so-called public, without acknowledging its constituent elements? Where does the individual appear in this political calculus? And finally, are politicians and their appointees supposed to be the arbiters of what is fairly and objectively presented? How can one man or a group of men somehow change their nature from subjective creatures to objective ones? How are the millions of individuals who comprise the marketplace, who use their own money to reflect their own preferences, better protected by politicians with vested political interests who use other people's money to shape the world to their wills? As absurd, tyrannical, and ironically titled as it was, the so-called Mayflower Doctrine laid the groundwork for many federal radio and television policies to follow. Skeptics might say that the Mayflower Doctrine lasted less than 2 years, asking how such a short-lived policy could have such long-lasting effects. The reason's simple. The Mayflower Doctrine was only the beginning. It was swiftly turned into a much more detailed and explicit command a year later with the issuance of the mighty Fairness Doctrine, about which so many glowing leftist folk tales have been told, and to which modern politicians consistently refer as a way to return balance to the talk radio market. Like its predecessor, the Fairness Doctrine is far from balanced. It places control of the content of radio broadcasts in the hands of politicians, the very politicians the First Amendment was created to check. Like a piece of Orwellian newspeak, the title shields Americans from its true intent. Ironically, George Orwell could have had a field day considering the semantic legerdemain of the new FCC rule as he worked on his next novel. To that date, Orwell had made his name criticizing the policies of communist leaders in the USSR with novellas such as Animal Farm, but in his 1949 release, 1984, Orwell depicted a totalitarian superstate where language was manipulated to fool the masses. With enough repetition, the people of the country called Oceania actually started to believe the phrase, "War is peace and peace is war." They literally chose to love Big Brother. And as he wrote his novel, Americans under the Fairness Doctrine were getting a taste of the same thing. In these new United States of speech control, politicians and bureaucrats, not the citizens with free will to turn the dial, would decide what was fair. Radio license holders would have the content of their broadcasts regulated. They would be forced to present the views of the public in allotments acceptable to the bureaucrats, who, of course, were the arbiters of what was fair and were protecting Americans from their own choices. It seems only fitting that both 1984 and the Fairness Doctrine were written at the same time and issued only weeks apart in 1949. Indeed, there's something remarkably Orwellian about the doctrine's primary dictum. Quote, "It is axiomatic that one of the most vital questions of mass communication in a democracy is the development of an informed public opinion through the public dissemination of news and ideas concerning the vital issues of the day. The Commission has consequently recognized the necessity for licensees to devote a reasonable percentage of their broadcast time to the presentation of news and programs devoted to the consideration and discussion of public issues of interest in the community served by the particular station. And we have recognized, with respect to such programs, the paramount right of the public in a free society to be informed and to have presented to it for acceptance or rejection the different attitudes and views concerning those vital and often controversial issues which are held by the various groups which make up the community." End quote. In other words, Big Brother says, "The Commission will determine what is a reasonable percentage of their broadcast time. The Commission will determine what is of interest in the community served by the particular station. The actual listeners and advertisers who buy commercial time based on listener interest shall not. And, by the way, you better start believing that the United States government is a democracy, not a constitutional representative republic. We need to reinforce that falsehood so more people accept majority rule as the standard for governance. Thank you." Well, when it came to packaging lies and manipulating the language in favor of big government, Orwell's Ministry of Truth couldn't have done a better job. Now, forget the sticky problem of the U.S. Constitution Disregard the fact that there are as many opinions about issues as there are people. Skip the nagging reality that broadcasters need to make programming decisions that attract listeners, and the paradigm forced upon them by the FCC would make it virtually impossible to present controversial views from the most talented and listenable hosts available. The fairness doctrine is the law of the land, period. You're Winston Smith, and the FCC is O'Brien. Well, since the day the FCC was established, and perhaps even before that, with the creation of the FRC, Americans have become so accustomed to the federal government deciding what is acceptable to present on radio and television that they seem to overlook the sheer enormity of what the government broadcasting regulations represent. This public acceptance is due in part to the stealthy way in which politicians were able to grab hold of the radio spectrum early in its development. The inconsistency of conservatives to fight both government regulations over political speech and over inappropriate content, and the ability of the feds to depict spectrum scarcity as somehow different than the scarcity of other natural resources upon which certain kinds of expression, namely writing, were dependent. Perhaps politicians at that time, and people like Ed Markey today, ought to have been asked what people would have thought if the FCC had issued a statement like this. The Commission has consequently recognized the necessity for newspaper and book publishers to devote a reasonable percentage of their page space to the presentation of news devoted to the consideration and discussion of public issues of interest in the community served by the particular publisher. Would the American people have been so willing to let the government decide how much space newspapers could devote to certain topics and what issues to cover? Would they have stood up against paternalism and political manipulation, against mercantilism and corruption? Or would they have let it slide, placing in the hands of self-serving politicians the future of written dissent? Would they have ceded the future of the written word to the arbitrary whim of government? Once the American people accepted government regulation of the structural framework of broadcasting, the regulation of content was soon to follow. And it is this essential point which conservative boosters of things like talk radio need to understand. One cannot lobby on behalf of FCC guardianship against smut without accepting the false paradigm of federal ownership of the airwaves, and thus federal regulation of political content as well. Conservatives fight a losing battle if they do not deconstruct and put in its proper place the illegitimate business regulations and improper manipulation of private industry that were the hallmarks of the Federal Radio Commission and the FCC from the moment they were created. And to this end, it is important to see precisely how unjustified this structural interference truly is. And folks, that structural interference is what brings us to February's dilemma for so many people. The regulation of the television airwaves and the force placed upon broadcasters and viewers by the government to have to broadcast in digital and watch in digital through a converter box, even on their analog TVs. And that's the next step in our multi-part program at the Liberty Conspiracy. Next, we'll look at the development of the networks and how they came to be regulated by the federal government. We'll talk about the red and the blue networks, NBC, ABC, and even CBS. And then we'll start talking a little bit more about this digital transition that was forced upon us by the 1996 Telecommunications Act. So until next time, I thank you very much for tuning in to this special multi-part cast. In fact, probably before we get to part three, we'll have a special program coming up, even maybe later today, an interview with Sue Blevins of the Institute for Health Freedom. Sue Blevins is one of the few people in Washington, D.C. who is trying to fight the federal government's encroachment on your health privacy and your right to freely contract with health providers and insurance companies. We'll talk to Sue about a hidden provision in this new bailout proposal from Barack Obama, a provision that will force everyone in America to have his medical data placed into the federal government's hands electronically. We'll get to that one next, and then we'll finish off our FCC Telecommunications Triple Cast. So thanks very much for joining us. We'll hear some great music going out. I hope you've appreciated this. I really appreciate you listening. I'm Gardner Goldsmith, and as the prisoner says, be seeing you.
Sometimes I try to do things, and it just doesn't work out the way I want it to. And I get real frustrated. I try hard to do it, and I take my time, but it just doesn't work out the way I want it to. It's like I concentrate on real hard, but it just doesn't work out. And everything I do and everything I try, it never turns out. It's like I need time to figure these things out. There's always someone there going, hey, Mike, you know, we've been noticing you've been having a lot of problems lately, you know? Maybe get away. And, like, maybe you should talk about it. You'll feel a lot better. And I go, no, it's okay, you know? I'll figure it out. Just leave me alone. I'll figure it out, you know? I'm just working on myself. They go, well, you know, if you want to talk about it, I'll be here, you know? And you'll probably feel a lot better if you talk about it. So why don't you talk about it? I go, no, I don't want to. I'm okay. I'll figure it out myself. They just keep bugging me. They just keep bugging me. There's pills on the side. It's got to be a suicide. So come and pray with one side. You will have anything. I pray with you to get away. I'm not crazy. Here's the desire. You're the one who's crazy. Here's the desire. You're driving me crazy. Here's the desire. They take me in an instant. Cause that was the only solution to give me any professional to take me from the enemy myself. I was in my room, and I was just like staring at the wall, thinking about everything. But then again, I was thinking about nothing. And then my mom came in, and I didn't even know she was there. She called my name, and I didn't hear her. Then she started screaming, Mike, Mike! And I go, what? What's the matter? She goes, what's the matter with you? I go, there's nothing wrong, Mom. She goes, don't tell me that. You're on drugs. I go, no, Mom, I'm not on drugs. I'm okay. I'm just thinking, you know? Why don't you give me a Pepsi? She goes, no, you're on drugs. I go, Mom, I'm okay. I'm just thinking. She goes, no, you're not thinking, you're on drugs. Normal people don't act that way. I go, Mom, just give me a Pepsi, please. All I want is a Pepsi. And she wouldn't give it to me. All I wanted was a Pepsi. Just one Pepsi. And she wouldn't give it to me. Just a Pepsi. He went through it with the seat. Not really back to see a seat. Just yucky, just lazy. It's a good deal, crazy. I'm not crazy. Here's the dessert. You're the one that's crazy. Here's the dessert. You're trying to be crazy. Here's the dessert. They stick me in and I was sitting in my room, and my mom and my dad came in. They pulled up a chair and they sat down. They go, Mike, we need to talk to you. And I go, okay, what's the matter? They go, me and your mom, we've noticed lately you've been having a lot of problems. And you've been going off for no reason. And we're afraid you're going to hurt somebody. And we're afraid you're going to hurt yourself. So we decided that it would be in your best interest if we put you somewhere where you can get the help that you need. And I go, wait, what are you talking about? We decided my best interest? How do you know what my best interest is? How can you say what my best interest is? What are you trying to say? I'm crazy? When I went to your school, I went to your churches, I went to your institutional learning facilities. So how can you say I'm crazy? Say to go to the people crazy, leave me suffering in my face. By the time they think I had better leave, I'll be dead. I'm not crazy.